Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, subscribe to us through iTunes, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Art of Cinematography series. Tonight, we speak with Darius Walsky. Films that grace Mr. Walsky's resume include Romeo is Bleeding, Tony Scott's Crimson Tide and The Fan, Alex Proyas's Dark City and The Crow, each installment of the hugely successful Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland and Sweeney Todd, and recent work with legendary director Ridley Scott that includes Prometheus, The Counselor, and his next film, which is currently in pre-production, Exodus. You are currently in pre-production on Exodus, the new Ridley Scott film. Is that what you're doing?
That is correct.
So that seems like another massive, very ambitious undertaking. What does that prep involve? How long is it?
We're looking at locations. I think it was, hang on, let me be correct with you, probably like 2 months ago. And now we're in full prep. You know, it's a big movie. But, you know, no matter how big they are, they still try to be very financially efficient. And Ridley especially is very financially conscious. So we're shooting the film partially in London, on stages in Pinewood, and rest of it we're shooting it in Spain and Canary Islands. Mm. So first we looked at all the locations, and we scaled down everything to Almeria, which is part of Spain, and Fuerteventura, which is island in Canaries. Yeah, it's very kind of desert-like, looks like Sinai.
Mm. You know, when I think of you've worked on some massive movies, whether it be your collaborations with Ridley or the Pirates movies or the Tim Burton films. I just think, from an outsider's perspective, I would look at that project and I would think, this is just too big. It's insurmountable. So is pre-production a question of just chipping away and problem-solving a little bit at a time?
A bit of both. I mean, you just look at the whole scope, your wish list, what you would love, and then you just look at it logistically, how you can accomplish it within the confines of the budget.
So take me back to the beginning a little bit. What those first yearnings were to be a part of filmmaking, and what drew you to cinematography in particular?
Well, you know, I come from Poland, and when I was very young, I was just a bit of troubled with what I want to do with myself. And I spent a lot of time playing hooky, going to movie theaters, early shows. Left home, and in Poland they had a 10 o'clock show for senior citizens. So I used to sneak in and watch movies. And actually, there was some great revival theaters too. And so I was exposed to a lot of old movies and stuff. And I figured, I gotta do it, you know. So.
Were there particular DPs or particular films that left the greatest impression on you?
Yeah, well, when you get older, you start noticing DPs and their work. Yeah, I mean, obviously, Greg Tolan and Citizen Kane was a huge influence. I mean, was like a staple of taking cinema to a different level. And then there were all those great cameramen from James Wong Ho, and then great American cameramen from 70s like Conrad Hall, a bunch of them were foreigners, Bruce Surtees, and then Vilmos Zsigmond, Laszlo Kovács, so we're just looking, admiring them. And then while you just get involved in the business and trying to get a work as a cameraman, there was all the English waves with Peter Bijou, Michael Saracen, I mean Ridley Scott, of course, and stuff. And then I got lucky. Yeah.
Did you, when you were first kind of embarking on the business, who were your mentors?
Well, it was tricky because I didn't have any mentors because I came to New York. One mentor who was pretty influential was at film school in Poland still, was Wojciech Sobociński, was a Polish cameraman who was really cutting edge at the time, and he was doing all the movies with Bajda and a lot of interesting Polish films. So that was a person, and there was somebody who I met in person who had a bunch of workshops with us at school. He really stand out, but he was very non-conventional in comparison to our teachers. They were very kind of old school and old fashioned and stuff. So that was the first thing. And then my mentors was just watching movies that I loved, and I never met them, but just watching them carefully. And like Storaro was a huge influence.
Mm.
Michael Saracen, Peter Bijou, Conrad Hall, but it was just watching their work. I met them eventually down the line, briefly, you know. I met Conrad Hall in the park with my kids. He was with my kid when he was with his grandchildren. So someone introduced me to him. But it's always intimidating to somebody who's done all this great work. And like, what are you going to say? but I love your work. I mean, it's going to sound so hokey.
Yeah. Well, I feel the same way talking to people like you. I mean, your work is amazing to me.
I even had the same story with Ridley, because I met Ridley through because I worked with his brother first, and I met him socially once because I'm friends with his son, and the first time I met him, I just didn't know what to say. I was completely quiet. So, hi, and that was it. I wanted to say something, but, you know, it's like, I figured, like, whatever I'm going to say is going to sound so corny, so I just kept my mouth shut.
Yeah.
And then I went home and was like, God, I should have said something. I should have talked to him.
I know exactly how you feel. I'm just so afraid to say something and make a fool out of myself in front of this person that I idolize. So I know exactly what you mean. Tell me when you started. Did you start in music videos, or when did music videos come in for you?
Well, when I came to New York straight from film school in Poland, it was basically a survival. It was just like, I figured if I get any job in film business, maybe I'll get lucky eventually. So I started like hanging out around Columbia University. I knew somebody, so I shot some film, student films. Then I worked as a PA, you know, just did everything, a bit of camera assisting, a bit of being an electrician. I did quite a bit of work for BBC, not as a cameraman, as an electrician or as a camera assistant, but it was for BBC in New York, which wasn't much of a training as a cinematographer when I had mine, but it was a great place to be introduced to American English culture, because BBC used to do amazing documentaries. That was a great like opener into the world that was new to me, you know, interviewing people like, you know, Katharine Hepburn, Warren Beatty, you know, all this stuff, Arthur Miller, you know, a lot of scientists, a lot of very interesting people.
Mm.
So that was it was more of a life experience, life learning experience than learning the skill of a cinematographer. But it's like when you're young and trying to get your break, you have all this time, so you're just making your own movies in your mind, you know, when you watch other films, you know. So eventually when you get your break, then you just kind of try to throw everything in that you were thinking to be able to do it.
Yeah. You know, one of your earliest movies I've always loved, Romeo is Bleeding. And you actually, you know, you mentioned a lot of, when you just mentioned the list of DPs, I mean, they're, a lot of their work in black and white film is so striking and experimental and daring. Can you apply any of those kind of black and white techniques into a color film noir like Romeo's Bleeding?
Of course, yeah, because, you know, you... Because the black and white is just like a great, you know, everyone should shoot black and white because that's, you have to create everything with lighting because you only have two, you have just white, black, and all the grays are shades of gray. So even when we shoot color, we still apply to create a great composition, great lighting, great image. Every great image, if you just turn the color out, it's going to look great.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then there was a time I remember when I was already pretty successful in videos and commercials. We used to do a lot of commercials black and white. It's hard to believe. There was a time that I was working all the time in commercials, but my reel was all black and white.
Wow.
So even though, like right now, it would be just totally unacceptable that the agency has so much influence on that.
Well, but you also... I mean, I was talking to Stefan Chomsky the other day about Ed Wood, and he said, you know, he found that you could probably make the lighting a little harsher in black and white and get away with it.
Yeah, that is true, that you have to exaggerate a little bit,
That
you have to, that you can go, but as a train of thought, I think it's great movies are just, you know, if you take the color out, they're going to look great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like on The Crow, we were trying to desperately make it black and white, but we couldn't. And right now you have all those technologies to desaturate images, pull the color out. And those days, we just couldn't. The only movie that was made at the time that color was desaturated optically was called 1984, the Roger Deakins show. And that was, I was just like, that was a Bible. It's like, God, how did he do it? How did he do it? So we made all the research, you know, there was a whole, you know, chemical process and stuff. But it was so expensive that just we had no chance, you know, to do that.
Well,
so we just had to do everything with lighting, you know.
And you're definitely in something like The Crow. You're definitely not afraid to explore the darker images. And, you know, I think of someone like Gordon Willis, who became known as the Prince of Darkness because he embraced darkness in his frame. But when you're working in film, is there always a question of, is this too much?
Well, when you're young, you try to push everything to extremes, you know. Then once you've done it, and didn't get fired, then you start a little bit, you know, just start mellowing out, you know. But in the beginning, we all were trying to just darker the better. I mean, because I grew up when music videos scene when with David Fincher, Alex Proyas, we were like young, arrogant kids trying to push envelopes as hard as we can.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did Crow and I... bumped into Fincher, he said, no, you made it pretty dark. And then when he did Seven, I called him, I said, oh, you made it darker, okay. So it was like, who's going to go darker? That was the whole thinking, you know, we were just all, you know, always on the edge of being fired. I mean, Romeo's Bleeding, I was very fortunate because when the first dailies came out, all the producers were sitting there, it was like a long pause, it's too dark, and I said, oh my God, I'm going to be fired. And Gary Oldman said, oh, I love it. So I was off the hook, you know. But if it wasn't for the actor who has just also worked with great cinematographers, is into great images, you know, they would be, I'm sure they would be on my ass. I was too dark. We don't see his eyes or something.
Well, this is another thing that I've been discussing a lot with the photographers that I've been interviewing, is that, you know, you want to be bold and experimental in your choices, but you don't want it to distract from, you don't want it to draw attention to itself necessarily. You don't want it to distract from the scene and the story. That must be,
yeah,
be a battle.
Yeah, you learn this once you start making more movies, that it should have a function, you know. Like when we did Prometheus, we did scenes that were super dark, but also we did scenes that were super bright, you know. So there was just like to you dramatically go into dark world, but you're just desperately trying to see something, and then you just see so much that it's just overwhelming, you know. So I think that the whole thing should be used dramatically, you know. It should be. That's why when you work with good directors, strong directors that are not afraid of, you know, of darkness, you just use it dramatically. You just say, okay, we're going to make this really dark, you know, and another scene director, you know, let's just make it bright, or let's just, I want to see his eyes now because it's an important scene, you know. So that's how you basically create the whole film dramatically, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the movie's interesting. It's not like it's lit the same way, you know.
Well, you've worked with, this is what's remarkable about your career and all the people that you've worked with, from Proyas to the Scott brothers, on and on and on, Tim Burton, very visual filmmakers. And I know there are all kinds of different directors. There are some that aren't necessarily as much into the visuals as they are the intricacies of the performances and all that. But when you're working with directors with such a strong visual sense, do you feel more challenged, like you're being pushed more?
No, it's more liberating, you know.
Mm.
Because you can push yourself more, you know, and you have the support. That's all.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what's great. That you just shoot some tests, you show it to them, and you just can keep going further, you know. And that's what's great about it, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about working with Tony Scott.
Well, exceptional person, yeah. Exceptional. Exceptional person. One of the hardest working directors I've ever worked with. And a great human being. Mm. Really, really special human being, yeah.
Well, Crimson Tide is one of my favorite movies, actually. And,
oh, thank you.
And you know, it feels claustrophobic.
Well, it was, yeah, claustrophobic. Yeah, it was a huge challenge because, you know, I was young, I had a lot of energy and a lot of my own ideas, and then working with a director who has a lot of experience, his own ideas. So there was always a bit of a fight, but fight like a creative fight. It was never about. It was never personal. It was about what's better on the screen. You know. So, yeah, it was exceptional. Yeah.
Well, and in Crimson Tide also, you're working with two of the greatest actors that there has ever been. I mean, and you can't get more natural than these two actors. And, you know, I watch somebody like Gene Hackman, and Denzel is a lot like this too, but you watch them and I've heard directors talk about directing them, and they're not exactly sure when they've started acting because it feels so so natural. But I want to know from your point of view, what your relationship is like to the actor. Do you get a sense from them of how they like to be shot or where they come across best?
Well, really good actors don't. They just focus on performance, you know. And they, you know, some actors, yes, were very concerned the way they're going to look like. But I was pretty fortunate that actors I work with are concerned about the performance, and there's a trust, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a trust. I mean, there has to be relationship because they help you out sometimes. You know, if you do something dramatic, that they have a little bit less freedom and movement and stuff. So you have to be very clear with them about it, and they're great. They're absolutely great. And if they need room, then you give them. But if you want to do something dramatic, then you tell them, listen, just stay really right here. It's going to be great. And they know. The good actors know. They know the lighting. They just look around. They just totally know what's going on.
Yeah,
De Niro knows exactly what he's, you know. before I came, they've worked with great cinematographers before. You know what I mean? So it's not like, you know, it's actually great because great, good actors are, yeah, experienced and they just know exactly what it's all about.
With something like Dark City or any of your movies, do you reference, is there a period of time where you reference other films or maybe paintings to find the look that you want?
All the time, there's a discussion about, you know, this and this and painters and photographers and, and old movies and, you know, we're just, the movie business is so eclectic by now because everything has been done, so you just can't stop with throwing references. It's impossible to put the camera anywhere without, oh, that looks like so-and-so, that looks like this and this. But also you have to be kind of subtle with it, because if you're too obvious, then it becomes, you just have to take somebody else's work and have your interpretation of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference from like blatantly ripping something off or being inspired by something, you know.
I was reading an interview with the DP, and he was talking about the difference between a camera being an active participant or, you know, like another performer in the scene, as opposed to just being an observer. Do you have a preference?
You know, it's really that is very much of a decision of the director and a decision of what story you're telling. You know, what's the script? What's the, you know? It's very much, but you know, it's. Both things are beautiful. I mean, the master of it is Scorsese, who can be just very, very, very objective and suggestive with the camera, you know. And at the same time, when there's a great performance scene, he can just completely stop and just be just observant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually, I think he's one of the best directors who truly understands that he can, you know, he has memorable shots, you know, big Steadicam shots, big cranes, big quotes from other movies too, of course, because he's obsessed with it. He's seen every movie ever made. You know? It's like a computer who just remembers all this. So you can see that. But in the same time, there's a great scene in Cape Fear between De Niro and Juliette Lewis. There's a medium shot of him and a medium shot of her, and that goes on forever. That's it. That's nothing.
Yeah.
Two static cameras. And then there's a lot of other shots and camera moves suggest something, becomes very subjective. And then he stops, you know, and all of a sudden it's powerful, you know. You know, he's a master of using the film language, you know.
And Ridley,
in a way, too. I mean, he's, Ridley is master of, like, a super wide shot. I mean, big, epic, you know, like, anytime he draws his storyboards, he draws this huge landscape, and then he says, just give me a fine pen, and he just puts a couple dots and these are people, you know. It's like, wow. So I mean, it's I've been pretty lucky working with big directors.
Yeah, and also when they do move the camera, which Scorsese does quite a bit, he loves a moving camera, but it really expresses the theme of the scene.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what it's all about, you know. Sometimes you go, oh, let's just shoot the whole movie handheld. Say, yeah, sure, I can shoot the whole movie handheld. I mean, it's not a big deal. But then it becomes like the one way of narrating a film. There's no pauses, there's no, you know. It's like basically, it's like a music score that just has one rhythm and there's nothing else there, you know. When you listen to sophisticated music, it has, you know, parts that are quiet, the parts that are loud, the parts of the dynamic, fast tempo, then there's a slow tempo, everything is there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you can make a piece that's just one way, you know. And unfortunately, cinema right now, it's very, very, very predictable, and everything is very, very kind of conventional, formulaic.
I think that's reflective of the material. I mean,
that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because I think people on the outside can always blame things like technology and moving away from the film medium, but I think it has to do with the story. I mean, the story is really king.
Yeah, and the stories are pretty predictable and flat, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm with you.
Characters are flat, you know, so everything just follows.
So when you're working on the Pirates movies, which you worked on all of them, I believe, you've established a look for that world, and you carry it on in the other films. But did you feel a lot of room to kind of play with that look in each of these films?
Absolutely, every one of them, we try to do it a little different.
Yeah.
Push it further. Yeah, do it different. Yeah. It's actually pretty funny. I did this documentary, which is still in process, about Keith Richards with Johnny basically producing and directing, and we had all these set up those scenes kind of with lots of candlelight and stuff, and it's quite an amazing film that's going to come out eventually, and then we did some pickups with Keith and Tom Waits. Finally I said to Johnny, I can't just look at candles anymore. He says, I can't look at them either. No, you've done it. You just milked it to the extreme.
Yeah.
Even though Exodus is going to have a lot of, you know, flame too, because that's the period. You know?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm speaking to, I think tomorrow, I'm speaking to the Bruno Debonnel, who's shooting now with Tim Burton.
Yes.
You shot some amazing work with Mr. Burton too, but something like Alice in Wonderland, for instance. I mean, I understand that movie is almost entirely green screen. What are the challenges there? That must be
the huge challenge, because you're just shooting actors on the green screen, and you have renderings, you have models of the sets, you have kind of computer pre-visualizations of the sets, but you know, it still doesn't really represent what you want to do. So you do have to imagine a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And you have to constantly talk to Tim, and then okay, so this is not, this is this. And you have to do, you know, the hardest thing about blue screen is that you spend more time just dealing with blue screen than lighting actors, because you know. So that's the hardest thing. So you just have to create kind of an environment that gives you flexibility and of changing things, and you're in the same place, but now you're at night, now you're day, now you're bright, sunny day, now you're just kind of, you know, in the forest or something. So just creating all the shadows and stuff that God hopefully is going to interact right with whatever it's later to come. So it is a challenge.
So that must be a huge question mark for you when you're shooting something like that.
It's extremely frustrating, and it's just not the way to make movies, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, James Cameron is a genius in that, but, you know, he took 4.5 years to do Avatar, so he's in his own league.
You've shot a couple of 3D films. Are you shooting Exodus in 3D?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Do you enjoy the challenges of that technology?
Yeah, I mean, it's all it is just you have to do just incredible amount of prep work, because technology is overwhelming, so you have to really be on top of it, and you have to surround yourself with really, really good people, because there's very few good people who really understand that 3D. There's a lot of people who are smart about it, but they're not really filmmakers, so you just have to find this group of people that understand that they're very good in this stuff, because you need a serious support and in the same time they're filmmakers, so they just, and you have to constantly challenge them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we've proven that half of the rules that we've been told about 3D are not true, and it worked for Prometheus, worked for Pirates, and it's gonna work for this one. So you just cannot be completely constricted by technology. And, you know, with Ridley, it's great, because he's so visual, and it's such a second nature for him. the minute I just took me 10 minutes to explain how the whole thing works. And he said, okay, I got it. Meantime, you go to some training camps at Sony, people discussing and stuff and this, and then you look at it, it doesn't even look good. What are you doing, guys?
Yeah, yeah. But does it feel to you like, I mean, we've moved from celluloid to digital. We're in a 3D age. Does it feel to you like you're on the beginning stages of something exciting with filmmaking?
It's just a big challenge, and I'm not sure if the 3D movies are really answer the movies. It's like it's a challenge. We've done a few. We're going to do one more, but it's not necessary. It's not. You know, it's just, it's absolutely not. It doesn't make a movie any better. It's just, I mean, it makes it better a little bit, you know, this, because when you see it, even good 3D film, you're aware of it for like, okay, a couple of shots, and then you go into story, and then, oh, boom, oh, okay, it's 3D, that's cool. And then you're back to the story.
Yeah.
But you have to kind of be careful that it's not gimmicky, you know. I don't know what the rules are, but it's just a fine balance about when it's 3D and when you want to push it, when you want to make it stronger, when you have to back off, you know.
Before I let you go, this is the last question I ask all of our DPs. If you were to teach a class in cinematography, which you may have done, but looking over the history of film, what scenes or films would you show your students to teach them various lessons?
I would definitely go with classics, you know, like Citizen Kane, Blade Runner. I just jumped quite a bit. then I would go, you know, like for Hang Up, there was a lot of great movies between. I would just definitely show old German expressionism. I would show the Russian avant-garde. I would show, there's just so many great movies. I would show American movies from 70s, of course, Godfather. Then I would go like from Godfather to Medium Cool, which is completely opposite films. But that was a time when everyone was just trying, you know. Definitely Conrad Hall with In Cold Blood. Film noirs, back and forth. They should watch them. all the Malta Falcons and so forth. I mean, those were low budget films.
Mm-hmm.
All the film noir genre was a low budget genre. So the guys had to be very fast, very decisive with the lighting. They have to create a character and atmosphere. And somebody told me that the reason they're so dark is they didn't have any money to light longer. You know. There was a lot of brain to it. I don't believe this completely. But quite often we're in situations like this too, that the scenes are so big and so complex that you have to really light in a very simple way, you know, because otherwise it's just going to be too complicated.
Well, when you do these huge movies, which you've been doing one after another, do you long for... To go to something a bit more intimate, like the Keith Richards documentary, I would think.
I did this film that I'm very proud of, and it was my last film on film, and I had this instinct when I shot on Super 16, because I said, this is it, this is going to be last chance to shoot on Super 16. It was called Rum Diaries.
Yes.
Bruce Robinson directed it. It's based on Hunter Thompson, early novel. And I'm extremely proud of this film. It was just two 16mm cameras, and we just shot it. You know, it was great.
That's it for this episode of the Art of Cinematography series. You can find additional episodes in the series by visiting moviegeeksunited.net/artofcinematography.